I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. Well, I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we have a very special honor. We have with us one of the foremost thinkers, commentators on law, the Constitution, and in particular, freedom of speech with us today. We are honored to have with us Jonathan Turley. Many of our listeners know Jonathan, have seen him, seen his work, seen him in national media. He is the Shapiro Chair for Public Interest Law at George Washington University Law School. He is a regular commentator in the national media, including on Fox News, where undoubtedly many, many of our folks have heard him and seen him. The author of a number of really terrific books and articles. Really, I think he's one of the leading legal commentators today, and a well-known and active, strong defender of individual liberty and understanding our Constitution in terms of individual liberty. And as I say, the author of many books, including a very important new book called The Indispensable Right, Free Speech in an Age of Rage. The book places attacks on free speech in a historical context. It's fascinating reading for anybody who cares about American history and cares about the importance of freedom of speech in our society. Jonathan Turley, thanks for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea.
Thank you, Jeff. It's great to be with you.
The book, The Indispensable Right, I think the title bears some explanation.
Well, it's funny because I use The Indispensable Right because it's a quote from Louis Brandeis from a case called Whitney. Brandeis, of course, was one of the great civil libertarians on the court, and he referred in this opinion to free speech being that indispensable right, and it most certainly is. All other rights depend on this right, from religion to assembly. They all require forms of expression. But the interesting thing is that that reference came in an opinion where he upheld the conviction and incarceration of a woman who was a communist, who was arrested for simply engaging in political speech. She was arrested in a speech where she spoke against lynchings across the country. So it was that weird anomaly that attracted me to that particular phrase, because everyone seems to agree that free speech is indispensable, but not why. And also why we continue to struggle with it. And the subtitle refers to free speech in an age of rage. And it doesn't say the age of rage. It's an age of rage. This isn't our first age of rage. It may be our most dangerous, but it's not our first. And so from the beginning of our republic, we have struggled with what I call in the book, rage rhetoric. You know, this country was formed in rage. That's what the Boston Tea Party was. And yet we have struggled with how we deal with rage. And rage rhetoric by citizens has often produced what I call state rage, where the government has cracked down on free speech. So the book tries to tell that history through the personalities and periods that shaped our view of free speech.
So, of course, your book talks a lot about free speech in the time of the American founding. And I think a lot of our folks might think, and certainly American citizens around the country might think, well, yeah, everybody has always agreed on the importance of free speech in this country. And it's only today where we're seeing disputes and controversies over this. Your book makes clear that's not true. We've had disputes, controversies, and rage about freedom of speech from the very founding.
Oh, that's absolutely true. In fact, I call this an unvarnished history of our struggle with free speech because it's not always pretty. I mean, part of understanding free speech is to come to grips with our own history in cracking down on free speech and denying free speech to people that we were afraid of or we hated. And we have a long history of that from the very beginning. Of course, John Adams was one of the great violators of free speech. He used the Alien and Sedition Acts to arrest his opponents. And this book looks at each of those periods, but it starts at the earliest possible period after looking at when free speech was first protected in the ancient Greek states. It eventually comes to the United States, and the most revolutionary act of the American Revolution dealt with free speech. It was the cleanest break from what came before in English common law of any area of the U.S. Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. And the reason is that the people that wrote the First Amendment largely viewed free speech as a natural right, a right that came from God. It wasn't created by the government. It wasn't granted by the government. It pre-existed the government. And that clarity was truly revolutionary. It still is. You know, there are law professors that have organized against free speech. There's a massive anti-free speech movement. One of my colleagues has pushed an amendment to the First Amendment to change it, to allow free speech to be balanced against things like equity. She says that the First Amendment is simply excessively individualistic. That is a popular view among law schools today. So even today, the First Amendment is revolutionary. But we lost that brief moment of clarity within a few years. Federalist courts fell back to the default position of England and to the Blackstonian view of free speech, that free speech is protected because it's good for democracy. Well, it is good for democracy. That's unassailable. But it's much more than that. And so what this book tries to explore is what free speech really is to us, why it is a natural or human right, that we can't be complete, we can't be whole as humans without free speech. We even have physiological reactions to being denied expression. Parts of the brain actually shrink if you don't have the ability to speak, to create. We are hardwired for free speech.
It reminds me of an essay, I think it was written by James Madison in 1792, called Property. And he, in the essay, he actually says that we have a property in our mind and our opinions and our religious opinions. And then he says, and our sentiments and in the free communication of them, which I take to mean freedom of speech and freedom of press, as you write, as he says, as a personal right of the human person, not simply because it's socially useful.
That's right. And Madison was particularly strong on free speech. That in 1800, he wrote a wonderful paper which talked about all the prosecutions for sedition that were occurring. He was appalled by them. So was Jefferson. They even at one point, they started writing in code because they were afraid that they could be the next charged with seditious speech. And Madison wrote this wonderful paper that said that there's a monster that lives within us as a government, as a people, as a country. And that monster is sedition. It's the criminalization of speech. And it comes forth in moments of fear and anger. And Madison saw it for what it was. He saw that we were losing the clarity that existed when the First Amendment had been first drafted. And unfortunately, we've never been able to slay Madison's monster. One of the things this book argues for is it's time. It's time we slay the monster. It's time that we end sedition prosecutions. It's time that we return to the clarity of the founders and see this as a right that is given to every individual, not by government, but by God, that they are, by being human, they are persons that have a right to free expression, to project part of themselves to the world around them.
You talk also in the book about other historical moments, of course, in American history where free speech was particularly under assault in Age of Rage. And one area that would be known to some degree to our listeners would be revival of sedition acts and prosecutions for those, thinking, for example, in World War I, the Schenck case, the very famous Schenck versus United States case. Can you talk about the violations of free speech in that era?
Yeah, you know, the Schenck case is a particular obsession of mine. So is Oliver Wendell Holmes. There's a long chapter on Oliver Wendell Holmes. And I remember my Simon Schuster asked, do we really need a whole chapter on Oliver Wendell Holmes? And I said, my God, that's such a crazy question. Of course. The reason I focused on Oliver Wendell Holmes and Schenck is not just that he was one of the driving forces of what I call the functionalist view of free speech, this limited view of free speech that rejected a natural rights basis for free speech. But also, if you want to understand how we lost our way as a nation on free speech, you can understand that if you see where Oliver Wendell Holmes lost his way, that Holmes didn't just reject natural rights. What's striking about his opinions is the vehemence, almost the anger, when he talks about natural rights. And I really drill deeply into his history to figure out where that came from, going back to his time at Harvard, where I think that he was most clearly an atheist at Harvard. But then the Civil War really magnified his, frankly, his hatred for natural rights. He just didn't believe it. He had lost a faith that there were any transcendent rights. So when Schenck came down, this should have been an easy case for anyone who believes in the original view of free speech. This was pure political speech. This was just speaking out against the draft, against the building up of the war. These were socialists and anarchists who believed that this was a war that was going to ruin the working class, where they were fodder for the cannons. Now, you can agree or disagree, but it most certainly is pure political speech. And it was in that case that Oliver Wendell Holmes uttered perhaps the most unfortunate line in the history of the Supreme Court. I guess there's rivals on that one, but it would certainly be up there. And it was the line, indeed, about crying fire in a crowded theater. That line is used as a mantra today, and it always has since it was first drafted, to support censorship, the criminalization of speech. It is still being repeated by members of Congress. You know, I was testifying recently, not that long ago, when Representative Goldman from New York was chastising me as a free speech absolutist, because this was a hearing on censorship, which the Democrats were trying to defend. And he quoted the line, and I interrupted him and said, Congressman, does it matter to you that not only did Holmes at the end of his life walk away from that line, not only did the court walk away from that case, but it was a line used to imprison a socialist for pure political speech that you're quoting? And he immediately said, we don't need a law lecture here, and cut me off and reclaimed his time. You know, but that's what's so maddening about that line from Schenck, is that it can't withstand any review, but it is repeated just by everyone who wants to silence people with opposing views.
And of course, that case articulates what people have come to call the clear and present danger test, right, for free speech, right, social utility of speech. And it does seem, though, there have been moments where free speech enjoyed some more protection than others. I'm thinking of the Supreme Court in the 1960s, for example, in the Brandenburg case in 1969, where they seem to have, they haven't gotten away from the fundamental problem, but they seem to have allowed more speech to be protected. How do you respond to the argument that some folks have made, which is, well, that might have been true in the early 20th century, but since then, the Supreme Court and society has made much more progress on free speech?
Well, it has made progress. Brandenburg was an improvement. And also the 303 Creative case recently was an improvement, where the Supreme Court said that a web designer who had religious objections to working on a same-sex marriage website had a right to decline the work. And they got that right. Although the rationale in that case was a little bit conflicted. The problem is that for every one of these cases, there are two others that seem to cut the other way. The Supreme Court recently punted on looking at the massive censorship system on social media. But also, we are living in the most dangerous anti-free speech period of our history. I mean, the movement today is unprecedented in size. For all of those periods, and we've gone through some really bad periods, we've never seen the alliance that exists today in the anti-free speech movement, the joining of corporate, media, academic, and government interests against free speech. On college campuses, free speech is taught as a harm, as a threat. We have raised a generation of speech phobics, kids that are told that free speech endangers them, that they shouldn't have to listen to opposing views, that they should be triggered and they should stop others from uttering opposing ideas. That movement started in higher education and it's now metastasized in the media and in politics. I was raised in a liberal democratic family in Chicago. I would never have imagined that the Democratic Party would become the party of censorship and blacklisting. The McCarthy period involved these very same types of measures being used against the left, against socialists and communists. And now the left has perfected it to a degree that McCarthy could only have dreamt of. This massive censorship system was described by a federal judge as Orwellian in size.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
Let's talk a little bit more about that because it is very interesting. It seemed like campuses used to be in the 60s and 70s in the Vietnam era, the hotbeds of free speech. And now, as you say, they seem to be the places that seem to be most hostile. How has that change come about?
You know, this is, I don't consider myself naive, but Jeff, I remain truly unnerved by what I've seen over 30 years in higher education. I would never have thought that professors could ever support amending the First Amendment and fighting against free speech. But that's now the norm among faculty. I'm a sort of a dinosaur. People call me a free speech absolutist. That used to be a compliment. What I really am sad about is not the fact that we have law professors now who've dedicated their lives to fighting free speech. It's what it's meant to our students. You know, when I went to the University of Chicago, for me, it was like walking into the Star Wars bar scene. You know, we had so many different types of people. You know, everyone had different views, different values. I was staying at a house where Trotskyites met in the basement. Libertarians lived next door. Upstairs were militant vegans. I thought they were all crazy, but I loved every conversation I had with them. I love talking to people who could see something that I was seeing and see something so very different. It was a smorgasbord of different ideas. Now we've reduced it to sort of a happy meal, but nobody's particularly happy. It's a dialogue that runs from the left to the far left. Most faculties have purged their ranks of Republicans, conservatives, libertarians, dissenting voices. It's all now this homogeneous far left teaching academy. And our students have been denied something that was really special that we had. These academics who have destroyed diversity of thought are denying our students something they had. I have a very long chapter on higher education, and it was the chapter that I thought was most painful to write, because as I detail case after case of academics who were fired, investigated for just having dissenting views, it was remarkably depressing. But people don't know how bad it is. You know, the left on campuses today threaten everything that an intellectual values. They threaten your ability to publish, to go to conferences, to have associations, everything that an intellectual life needs. And they do that because it chills anyone else. That's why you have many academics who are chased from faculties or investigators fired, and there's no objections from their colleagues because they don't want to be next. And the result is horrifying. We had a professor in North Carolina who had to go to court repeatedly to preserve his job. He was conservative. And he succeeded each time. But then they found out he made some joke in a tweet or something. And they put him under investigation again. And this time they finally got him to accept a settlement to leave teaching. And basically almost on the last day where he would no longer be a professor, he went home and he blew his brains out. And people don't realize what it is to an academic to walk away from the one thing you've wanted to do your whole life. That's what can be taken from you if you put your head up, you stand up, if you defy the majority on campuses.
That's one of the things that I found so powerful about your book is talking about the human cost of the denial of free speech. And I think a lot of our listeners wonder, are their children or grandchildren on campuses around the country in the kind of atmosphere that you're describing? What is the effect, the cost on students?
It's a huge cost. You know, I had a student who came up to me a few years ago who was in my Supreme Court class, and it was at graduation. Her grade was in. So she said, this isn't an effort to kiss up. She said, I just want you to know that I went through 4 years of college and 3 years of law school, and your class was the last class I took. And it was the first class I felt absolutely free to share my views as a conservative. And I remember feeling, instead of complimented, incredibly depressed, that we're depriving something so special to these students, what college and law school education should be. It's really immoral what we've done, what we've allowed to happen. But part of what I try to do in the book, and this is why it took so long for me to complete it, is I didn't want to write just another free speech book that complained about the weather, you know, that it's getting worse every day. I wanted to have a book that actually suggested how we can have a reawakening, because you can't assume that just because earlier generations went through ages of rage, that so will we. This is different from all those other periods in the book. There is a movement in Europe, in Western Europe, where free speech is in a free fall. And that wave has now reached our shores. And there are allies here in the United States who want to replicate what's happening in France, Germany, England, where speech is being criminalized at a shocking level. We need to have an awakening. And this book talks about how the steps we can take to reclaim something that defines us.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because you, as you say, that distinguishes your book in its concluding time by laying out some possibilities for saying, let's clearly understand the magnitude and character of the threat to free speech, and here are some solutions. I know our listeners are going to want to say, okay, Jonathan, you've depressed me enough. Give me some hope. Give me some hope. What are some things we really can do to begin to restore free speech?
Well, first of all, as depressing as this history can be, I am an optimist. As I say at the end of the book, there's an advantage to believing in natural or human rights. There's an advantage to believing that we're hardwired for free speech, that's in our DNA, because it means that no matter how big you go with censorship, no matter how extensive your system, no matter how punitive your measures, you may be able to reduce the appetite for free speech, but you'll never extinguish the taste for it because it's in us. We need it. We can't help it. And that is something that gives me optimism. I don't think they can kill free speech without killing us. So there's always optimism. Now, what the book suggests are some concrete steps. Now, one of them is remarkably simple, but it will require changes in Congress. We need to pass a law that gets the United States government out of the censorship business. We need to pass a law that says not a single penny of federal funds can be used to target or blacklist individuals or groups based on what they are saying. Now, that doesn't mean that agencies can't talk in their own voice. Of course they can. That's free speech. They can go on the TSA website and say what they just said about us was untrue. Fine, that's great. That's more speech. What they can't do is censorship by surrogate, giving grants to all of these academic units and third-party groups that are making a fortune silencing and targeting others. So we need to cut off federal funds, and we need to retake higher education, starting with public universities. You know, these academics have become incredibly arrogant. You know, when they are confronted about the fact that they don't have a single Republican in their department, or students have reported, conservative students, that, and there's lots of surveys like this, that they don't feel safe on campus speaking their mind. They become irate at the suggestion that the state legislature would hold back money. Well, the taxpayer is not a captive audience. So if you want to create an echo chamber of far left views on your campus, then do it. Just go out and get donors to pay for it. There's lots of super wealthy liberal donors. Get them to pay for it. But you can't ask people in Oklahoma, Texas, Nebraska to continue to fund you when you exclude anyone that holds the values of a majority of the citizens in that state.
And of course, it also means that, and you have made this a hallmark of your career, worth noting, you have certainly yourself defended the free speech rights of people who I would certainly call unpopular. There's a certain amount of courage that's involved in what you're calling us to do.
You know, the free speech community often is in a position of defending the least popular among us. You don't need free speech for popular speech. You don't need the First Amendment for popular speech. Everyone likes it. The key is, are you willing to defend someone that you find grotesque, that you find offensive, but you are more concerned about protecting the right of free speech than you are extinguishing this one voice? It's a hard thing often to do. A lot of people aren't up to that task. But it's a uniquely American thing to do. Historically, we have gotten it right. We've come out of these ages of rage, and we have supported the dissenting views among us. That's what I mean about a reawakening. And by the way, one of the reasons I'm optimistic, Jeff, is that this movement came out of higher education, and it then went to the media, and then it went to the political establishment. It is not a popular movement. There are no polls that suggest that this is a movement that is popular with the public. The public still rejects censorship. They don't want censorship on social media or any other form. It's still in our DNA. So this is an effort by this alliance to get people to do something they don't want to do. And to do that, they have to be afraid. They have to be really afraid. That's why in the media, you have these constant articles about how free speech is going to kill your job, maybe kill you. You know, there was New York Times just ran a huge piece entitled "The First Amendment is Out of Control" or something along those lines, and said that it only protects corporations today. Now, that's just obviously ridiculous. But the idea is to try to get people to be so afraid that a free people might be willing to give up part of their freedom.
As you look to the future and an age of rage that we're in, and what do you look for to say this could be the most dangerous threat going forward? I mean, you articulate that in the book, of course, but for our listeners to say, pay careful attention to this threat to freedom of speech.
It's really the alliance. You know, we now have some of our closest allies who are part of this anti-free speech movement. It's shocking what's going on in Great Britain, Germany, France. In Great Britain, a judge sentenced a person a couple years ago for having toxic ideologies. That is basically a thought crime. They arrested a woman who was doing a silent prayer near an abortion clinic. It was a prayer to herself. In France, they've arrested people who have protested homosexuality, even comedians who've made jokes about different groups. So this alliance is huge. But what's different about the United States at this moment is that the traditional champions of free speech used to be academia and the media. They are now some of the loudest anti-free speech groups in this movement. It's unrelenting. That you'll see just all these columns telling people how horrible free speech is, how the First Amendment is out of control. They're pounding away to try to get a free people to give up their freedom. The one chance we have is really that we will confront the faithless with our own faith, to take that leap of faith, not in just free speech, but in each other, to say, no, we really will fight for people that we don't agree with. In 1800, Jefferson did exactly that. He ran against John Adams on the basis of free speech. He said that Adams, with all of his arrests, was destroying free speech. Adams lost in large part because of those arrests in that history. Perhaps 2024 will allow us to have the same chance. Let President Biden and Vice President Harris defend this record on free speech. I'd like to hear it. They've spent 4 years fighting every effort to disclose the censorship system, to shut it down. President Biden said that companies that don't censor Americans are, quote, killing people. Now, that was involving COVID, where scientists who have been vindicated today were raising concerns about what was being done. That's the reason when people say free speech kills people, it's the actual opposite. Free speech allows us to challenge things that are very important for public health. Some of those scientists were saying there's no need to shut down schools, that perhaps natural immunities are as good as a vaccine. Those were all vindicated with time. And so the question is, how many people suffered, continue to suffer, because we didn't have that debate?
Yeah, very important. For our listeners who care about freedom of speech, who want to understand its history and the contemporary controversies, have to most highly recommend this wonderful book by Jonathan Turley, The Indispensable Right, Free Speech in an Age of Rage. Jonathan, thanks for taking the time to be with us today on The American Idea.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been an honor.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.